what they're in.
Welcome. Bienvenue, bienvenue à l'Université McGill, bienvenue aux amis de l'Université, bienvenue à nos invités, bienvenue au Symposium public de sciences Laurent Trottier, qui est cette année, dont l'hôte cette année est le département de physique. Je suis le professeur Charles Gale, je suis le directeur du département de physique. Welcome to McGill University, welcome to the Friends of McGill, welcome to our guests, welcome to the Laurent Trottier Public Science Symposium, hosted this year by the Department of Physics. I'm Professor Charles Gale. I'm the chair of the physics department. Physics is a fascinating science, as you know. We're beginning to realize now the microscopic structure of elementary particles will influence the very shape, the very formation of our own universe. And this is a fascinating story we'll hear tonight. So this story is unfolding, and I'm glad you could all make it to hear a very interesting portion of it. And an event like this takes a lot of organization. So before we start, I'd like to thank a couple of people. There are a lot of people involved in the organization of something like this, and you'll meet some of them as the event unfolds. You'll meet our moderator. You'll meet our stellar panel. But I'd like to bring your attention to two persons right away. So behind the scene, this symposium could not have been what it is without the work of the symposium coordinator, Ms. Bonnie Brayton. So, Bonnie, please identify yourself. Thanks again for your hard work. And frankly, this panel, which is first class, it's an amazing collection of scholars, could not have been put together without the work of a professor in the Department of Physics, Professor Robert Brandenburger. Robert. Without further ado, let's tackle the big questions. So to pursue the evening, I call upon Professor Tony Massey, the provost of McGill University.
Thank you very much, and welcome to all. Monsieur et Madame Trottier, Madame et Monsieur, je vous souhaite la bienvenue au deuxième symposium en sciences Laurent Trottier. Une coïncidence cosmique, pourquoi l'univers convient-il à la vie? This is the second Laurent Trottier Public Science Symposium at McGill University, and we're very pleased to have this symposium along with many others at McGill. McGill has a long tradition of scholarly discourse and prestigious conferences in a variety of domains, and it is a great pleasure for us to host these Laurent Trottier Symposia along with our other prestigious series such as the Beattie Lectures, the Birx Lectures, and the Millennium Lecture Series, among others. It is a distinct honor to acknowledge Laurent Trottier and the Trottier Family Foundation, who have made this exciting opportunity possible for us today. Laurent is a McGill engineering graduate and is the president of Matrox Electronic Systems. I would be grossly understating the case to call Mr. Trottier simply a friend of McGill University. Perhaps only this distinguished panel of physicists can fully appreciate and comprehend the number of zeros attached to Laurent's beneficence to McGill. The Laurent Trottier Information Technology Building, dedicated in 2004, came about thanks to a $10 million gift. Then, in 2006, we received a second, even more generous donation of $12 million to establish the Laurent Trottier Chair in Astrophysics and Cosmology in the Faculty of Science and the Laurent Trottier Chair in Aerospace Engineering in the Faculty of Engineering, and associated fellowships for graduate students in both faculties. The Trottier Family Foundation also sponsors this symposium annually at McGill to, and I quote, hold a public forum to inform and inspire debate and raise public awareness on contemporary issues confronting society today. And Mr. Trottier never forgets the annual fund at McGill, a role model for all of our alumni and alumnae. Laurent Trottier est également un homme de vision qui désire que les enjeux scientifiques actuels soient débattus sur la place publique. La société ne peut faire l'économie en discussion éclairée et accessible qui suscite l'intérêt du public à l'égard des grandes questions soulevées par la science. this series of symposia takes back a tradition of the 19th century and transposes it today on public debates. In its present form, it offers a great opportunity for all of us to be exposed to the great debates and the great minds in science. For this year's symposium, as Professor Gales has indicated, the Department of Physics was chosen as the host, and the topic is the anthropic principle, the controversial notion that the universe is somehow specifically tuned to support life as we know it. This has come to be one of the core issues being debated in string theory and modern theoretical physics, and is based on empirical observations in cosmology in terms of the presence of dark energy. And it touches upon the existential questions of life: what is the universe and what is our role in it? This symposium will be moderated tonight by a professor in the Department of Physics, Professor Victoria Caspi, and it is very fitting that she do so, because she was recently appointed the very first Long Trottier Chair in Astrophysics and Cosmology. Vicky Caspi also holds a Canada Research Chair in Observational Astrophysics and is the 2006 winner of the prestigious Stacey Prize in the Natural Sciences, which is awarded annually to a young scientist or engineer for notable contributions to research in Canada. Dr. Caspi, who is also a McGill graduate with an undergraduate honors degree in physics, earned her PhD at Princeton, and after several years as a professor at MIT, we got her back to McGill in 1999. She is an internationally respected expert on neutron stars, the dense remnants left after the gravitational collapse of massive stars. She is the leader of a team that has made major discoveries in the field of millisecond pulsars, including the discovery of the fastest rotating pulsar yet known. McGill has many outstanding young researchers, but Vicky Caspi is truly a leader among them, and she will have the honor of presenting the panelists to you in a few moments. But her accomplishments are marvelous, her energy is boundless, and her fit with McGill is perfect. The topic of this symposium is controversial, and that is what makes it great for a public debate in science. But there is no controversy, I think, about the fact that when you bring together a great benefactor, a terrific homegrown researcher as moderator, and a world-renowned panel of experts, you can expect and you will have a memorable evening in the best tradition of McGill University. Ladies and gentlemen, on with the show.
Why is the universe just right for life? Are the laws of physics the way they are solely by chance to allow us to exist? And does our existence play a central role in our understanding of the laws of nature, or are we irrelevant bystanders? Such questions have long lived in the domains of philosophy and religion, but very recently, some of the most unlikely of participants in the discussion, those for whom logic, math, careful experimentation, have over the years demonstrated over and over again that humanity is not central to our understanding of the universe. These people have begun with uncharacteristic emotional intensity to discuss terms that to others border on philosophy and metaphysics. These are hardcore theoretical physicists, observational and theoretical astrophysicists. The issue is the anthropic principle. Concisely stated, the anthropic principle, the subject of our discussion today, asserts that the fundamental constants of nature have the values they do simply because if they didn't, we wouldn't be here to observe them. By here, I don't mean here in Leacock 132 on a night when it's minus 20 degrees outside, which is particularly impressive, especially given that there is a Montreal Canadiens hockey game tonight. But by we wouldn't be here, we literally wouldn't exist. The very atoms out of which we were made never would have formed. The sun upon which we rely for our for energy would never have formed. Galaxies of stars would never have formed. They would never have formed out of the primordial soup that we understand to be characteristic of the early universe. Must we, in fact, rely on anthropic reasoning, usually shunned on principle by the physics community, to explain the observed properties of the universe? Or is anthropic reasoning just a way of hiding from the fact that we do not know the ultimate laws of physics and the lack thus far of a grand unified theory? Tonight we have assembled for you, thanks to the generosity of Lauren Trache, a powerhouse panel of physicists whose expertise in matters relating to the anthropic principle are unsurpassed in the world, or at least in the thus far explored pocket of the cosmic landscape. Paul Davies, he's the director of Beyond, Institute for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. He's an internationally renowned theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist, and an acclaimed author of over 20 books, including How to Build a Time Machine, and the very recent Goldilocks Enigma, Why is the Universe Just Right for Life? His popular science television productions, The Big Questions and The Cradle of Life, have won international acclaim. Professor George Estafiou, the director of the Institute for Astronomy at Cambridge University. Professor Estafiou is one of the world's best-known cosmologists, and for over 25 years he has combined deep theoretical insights with major observational campaigns to understand the large-scale cosmic web of galaxies. He is the principal architect of our current paradigm for understanding the formation of structure in the universe. Professor Leonard Susskind. He's the Felix Bloch Professor in Theoretical Physics at Stanford University. He is one of the leading figures in theoretical physics today and is widely recognized as being the father of modern string theory. He is the author of The Cosmic Landscape, String Theory and the Illusion of Intelligent Design. And he is a great proponent of the anthropic principle. And he recently posed the basic question at the heart of the anthropic principle debate: can science explain the extraordinary fact that the universe appears to be uncannily, nay, spectacularly well-designed for our own existence? And Professor David Gross, the director of the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics and the Frederick W. Gluck Chair in Theoretical Physics at the University of California at Santa Barbara, winner of the 2004 Nobel Prize in Physics for his contribution to the Standard Model of Quantum Physics. Dr. Gross has also garnered many other prestigious awards, including the Oscar Klein Medal, the Dirac Medal, and the Grand Medaille d'Or. The rules for this debate: each panelist will have 10 minutes to present his view on the discussion of the anthropic principle. I will provide a 2-minute warning in the form of a xylophone and additional noises as the speakers go over their allotted time. I'm going to be strict about this. And I must ask, please, all audience members to turn off cell phones during this event. So with no further ado, Professor Paul Davies.
Well, thank you, Vicky, for that very kind introduction. And thank you for covering a lot of the points I was going to make, thus leaving me a little bit more time. As Vicky mentioned, from the dawn of time, people have gazed at the world about them and asked the great questions of existence. Questions like, how did the universe come to exist? What is it made of? Is there a meaning to it all? And above all, people love to ask, why am I here? Now, for most of history, this has been the province of priests and philosophers, but in the past few decades, it's become part of science. Scientists are revisiting these age-old questions of existence. And I want to begin with a quotation from Einstein, who said in roughly these words, "I want to know whether the good Lord had any choice in the form of his creation." And what Einstein meant by this was a really big question. Could the universe have been different? Does it have to be as it is? And if it could have been different, why is it the way it is? And in particular, why is it fit for life? why are there people like Einstein who can ask such questions? The best way of thinking about this is in terms of a thought experiment. Imagine playing the role of God, and before you is a designer machine with knobs. And if you twiddle the knobs, it changes things about the universe. So you twiddle one knob, and it makes all electrons a little bit heavier. You twiddle another knob, and it makes gravitation a bit weaker, and so on. Now, we don't yet have funding for the real experiment, but you can do the theoretical exercise by working out that if you could tune these parameters independently, what would happen. Now, how many knobs are there? Well, probably 30-something in our present state of knowledge, but we don't know how many fundamental, how many real knobs there might be, because some of those knobs may be connected together. But the upshot of this simple exercise is that some of those knobs, at least, even the slightest twitch would prove lethal. And this has been recognized for a long time. I don't think there's a great deal of dispute about the sensitivity of some of these parameters when it comes to life. And the question is what to make of it. Now, Fred Hoyle, a British cosmologist with a characteristically pithy turn of phrase, said that the universe is a put-up job. It seemed to him that the universe was a fix, and he once said it's as if a super intellect had been monkeying with the laws of physics, because it does look like these underlying laws of physics and cosmology are, so to speak, fine-tuned for life. So what's going on? Well, like the story of Goldilocks and baby bear's porridge, it's as if the universe is just right for life. How can that be? Is it really a fix? What's the scientific explanation? Well, there are really three responses to this set of facts. The first is that life is just a lucky bonus. We think life and consciousness are important because we are examples. No doubt a rock thinks it's important too, if it can think. And so according to that point of view, one day we will know why the laws of physics are as they are and why the numbers I've been talking about have the values that they do. And so some people call this promissory triumphalism. One day we will have such a theory, and we'll hear later from David Gross that maybe string theory is going to do this. That's one possibility. The other is that what we've all along been calling the universe is nothing of the kind. It's just an infinitesimal component in a vast and more elaborate system known as the multiverse or the megaverse. And if we further suppose that among this vast array of different universes, they come with different laws, maybe distributed at random, then it's no surprise we find ourselves in a universe which is bio-friendly, because life simply couldn't arise in a universe which is bio-hostile, and there'd be nobody in those regions, in those universes, to ask that question. And the third possibility is that there is some some sort of intelligent design behind it all. Now, we did ask President Bush to join the panel tonight, but he was too busy working on his State of the Union address to come and talk to us about the state of the universe. Well, let me just say that I've carefully considered all three responses to this fine-tuning enigma, this Goldilocks enigma, and I think they've all got something to be said for them, and they've all got shortcomings. None of them delivers the complete answer. The other speakers will speak up for the advantages of these different points of view, at least the first two, so I'll just give a summary of some of the disadvantages. So might we one day have a complete theory of everything? I call this the incredible shrinking parameter set, that as we learn more and more about fundamental physics, so there are less and less numbers to fix. And maybe one day there'll be a unique theory which will fix all of those numbers. And on the face of it, that might seem to do the job. But it's clear that even if we had a unique theory, that is a theory that fixes everything, it would not be the only possible theory. It's very easy to imagine other theories. We could imagine a universe that's just empty space, maybe with one particle in it, obeying Newton's laws or something. So there obviously are other ways of doing it. And so among the vast, probably infinite set of possible unifying theories that would fix all the parameters, this universe, this maybe multiverse, is described by one such thing.
And Stephen Hawking expressed this very well. He said, what is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to govern? Because to have a universe like this, and maybe string theory is it, the traditional way of thinking about the laws of physics is that they were imprinted on the universe at the moment of the Big Bang, imprinted from without. In other words, that the laws somehow already exist. And there we are. That's the superstring Lagrangian. So somehow, if you believe that string theory explains everything, you have to believe that string theory is sort of miraculously selected from some platonic heaven of possible mathematical forms. Let's have a look at the briefly at the multiverse point of view. There are many, many universes. As Martin Rees says, we now think of the laws of physics as like local bylaws rather than federal laws. These would be valid in our cosmic region, but not universal. And I think that some sort of multiverse seems to be a generic feature of hot Big Bang cosmological models. If the universe cools from a hot Big Bang, it's likely to cool in a sort of domain structure in which the low energy physics, the cooled down physics, is going to vary from one to the other. So some sort of patchwork quilt of universes is a very natural feature. Lenny Susskind later on will tell us about his favorite way of doing that. But you see, once again, you need some sort of input. You need a universe-generating mechanism, something to make all those universes. So it's not like we've explained everything. And then when it comes to intelligent design, well, did God do it? That runs into the same problem that this God is also unexplained. And these different approaches to the problem of where do the laws of physics come from and why those laws, how did the choice get made, they all have the same problem, that they all appeal to something outside the universe in order to explain what's inside the universe. And my own point of view, and I've changed a bit over the last few years, but my own point of view is that we should try to explain as much of the universe as we can from within it before appealing to something that is outside it. And I think that there's a chance that we can come up with a principle that connects the existence of life and conscious beings like ourselves in a fundamental way to the existence of bio-friendly cosmic laws. And we can do that without appealing to anything outside the universe. We don't say it was imprinted on the universe at its beginning. These laws would be emergent with and co-explained by the universe itself. And I gather that later on I'm going to have 5 minutes extra. We'll all have 5 minutes extra in which we can chip in with some further thoughts. So I'm going to save my further explanation about that tantalizing set of ideas until I get my 5 minutes. Thank you.
So, in 1915, Einstein derived his equations of general relativity, and very soon afterwards, he started to think about making cosmological models. And in those days, the thought was that the universe was static, and he found that he couldn't do it. And so what he did was that he modified his equations and added in the new constant of nature, the cosmological constant, and with that, he was able to construct static models. So the cosmological constant measures the energy density of empty space. And so with that the introduction of this new term, he was able to produce static models. But in 1928, Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding. And when Einstein heard about this, he declared that introducing the cosmological constant was the biggest blunder that he'd ever made. Ever since then, the cosmological constant, the question of whether the cosmological constant is present, is zero, or what value does it have, has been an open issue and a very controversial issue. And through the history of cosmology, every now and again, the cosmological constant has been wheeled in to explain some peculiar anomaly, and then it's gone away as the anomaly has disappeared. Now, in modern times, the first hints that the cosmological constant might not be zero came from studies of the large-scale distribution of galaxies, and a few years later, really strong evidence for a cosmological constant came from studying distant supernovae. So the idea here is that you look at distant galaxies at high resolution with the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, and you keep imaging these galaxies, and every now and again you'll see a supernova explode in one of these galaxies. They're easy to find. You just look for these arrows, and they point to the to the supernovae. And then if you assume that the supernovae are standard candles, that they have the same luminosity, you can estimate their distances, and that probes the geometry of the universe. And in 1997, two groups published results of studies of samples of distant supernovae, and this is what they found. So on this axis, it's the matter density, the density of ordinary matter, in units in which a value of 1 corresponds to the density at which gravity would cause the universe to recollapse. And then this is the energy density of the vacuum on this axis, plotted in the same units. And the favored regions of this parameter space found by the two groups are shown by these ellipses. And so for any value of the matter density, they were finding evidence for a non-zero cosmological constant, and evidence that the universe was accelerating rather than decelerating, as one might imagine, from the gravity of just matter within the universe. Since then, the amount of data available to cosmologists to probe this vacuum energy, or so-called dark energy, has increased enormously. These cone plots here show the spatial distributions of two very large samples of galaxies, which have been used to study the large-scale distribution of matter in the universe. This picture shows the WMAP satellite, and WMAP is a satellite that's designed to measure temperature variations of the hot radiation that was generated from the Big Bang that's cooled down to a temperature of 2.7 Kelvin. But the temperature is not uniform over the sky. It varies by about 0.001% in temperature. And WMAP maps these temperature fluctuations to high precision. And you can use the pattern of those fluctuations as a cosmic fingerprint to determine the composition of the universe. This diagram shows results from WMAP. What this diagram shows is the amplitude of the fluctuations in temperature plotted as a function of the scale size of those fluctuations. The points are the results from WMAP. You can see that cosmology has turned into a high-precision science now. And the solid curve shows a theoretical model in a vacuum-dominated universe that fits the data very well. So this diagram shows different types of data. So this diagram shows the WMAP results with results on the expansion rate of the universe from the Hubble Space Telescope. And this red region is the favored region, and you can see that it corresponds to a vacuum energy density of about 0.7 and a matter density of about 0.3. This is combining the WMAP data with a survey of large, bright red galaxies. And again, the favored region is shown in red. And this is combining the WMAP data with recent data, two different supernova samples. And again, the favored region is in the same place. And then this shows WMAP data combined with the results from those two large galaxy redshift surveys that I showed you. So you can combine different data sets. If you get exactly the same results if you combine the results from the large redshift surveys with the value of the Hubble constant, for example, from the Hubble Space Telescope. So there are many ways of combining these data sets, and they all give you the same answers. So the experimental evidence for a non-zero cosmological constant is now irrefutable. It's basically a slam dunk case. So that's what we think the composition of the universe is. But it's made up of a few percent of ordinary atoms, and the 22% is made up of dark matter, weakly interacting matter, and the rest of it is in dark energy. Now, why is the dark energy such a puzzle? The answer is basically the coincidence between the energy density of the vacuum now with the energy density of matter. It gives the vacuum energy a characteristic energy scale of about a millielectron volt. And in particle physics, that's a very unnatural number. In fact, a naive particle physics calculation would predict a cosmological constant that's 120 orders of magnitude greater than the observed value. So the fact that we observe a value that's small and non-zero introduces a new constant in physics, which has a very unnatural value. And that's one of the reasons it's the unnaturalness of the value of the cosmological constant that has led to a lot of interest in anthropic explanations for this constant. And the anthropic explanation works as follows. That fundamental physics suggests that the universe is much more complex than we previously thought. As Paul described, the universe may be a multiverse consisting of an infinite number of infinite volume universes with many different values of the parameters, including the value of the cosmological constant. So in the vast majority of these universes, the cosmological constant would have a very, very large value. But if there are possible universes with a small value, even if the probability of having a small value is very low, if you have an infinite number of universes, then it'll happen somewhere. And so then we have this ensemble of universes. We could imagine populating these universes with Buzz Lightyears. If one of these astronauts were put in a universe with a value of the cosmological constant that's 120 orders of magnitude bigger than the measured value, he would explode instantaneously. In fact, and this is an argument that that was originally proposed by Steven Weinberg, it turns out that if the cosmological constant was slightly bigger than the value that we measure today, then galaxies and structure wouldn't have formed, and the astronaut would have nowhere to call home. So the anthropic explanation of the value of the cosmological constant, a really fundamental problem in physics, is a selection of only those universes where the cosmological is small enough that life can be sustained. Now, is that an explanation or an act of desperation? Okay. I will leave that question to my more illustrious colleagues.
Thank you very much, Professor Staffew. Right. And now we will hear from Professor Susskind.
Now, I don't know what to do with this.
Well, you've got to plug it in.
Oh. You expect wisdom from me, huh? No signal. No. would you like to take this up for me?
Maybe try the F8 trick.
F7, is it?
Or F7, on the
other F7. Side. No. I will have nothing to do with this.
Did you test?
We tested it, yes.
Well, so it's a lot of strikes again. Is it actually. Anything else? Carry the day by the power of your oratory alone.
We can wing it, that's fine.
Sleep water on the side?
Actually, no city was going to sleep.
The natives are getting restless.
Good. We have the wrong slides there. Well, let's just make do with what we have.
Okay, I have exactly 10 minutes to tell you the entire history of the universe, so I better go fast.
What I want to do is tell you about two basic physics mechanisms that underlie a certain view of the universe, the view that's been expressed here by my two very illustrious colleagues. But first, I want to ask a biology question. And the biology question is, how did a bunch of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and a few other elements come together to form as unlikely a piece of machinery as a human being? Was it accident? Was it design? Or was it something else? Well, most of us think that it was something else. At least I would hope that most of us think it's something else. In fact, let's just get this up here. I'm not very good at these things, as you can see. Most of us think it was something else. What else? Darwinian evolution, for most of us, in any case. What is Darwinian evolution? Darwinian evolution is basically the idea that random mutation, this random mutation occurring over and over again, created a branching tree of life that contained a bit of everything. Everything that was possible in any case. And some small fraction of the branches of this tree happened to be complex enough that those branches can ask questions. Nothing more than that. Random mutation. Well, let's go back one step. Boy, am I bad at this. Why did all of this work? Why was there such enormous diversity? How could there possibly be enough diversity in the possible life forms in order that there would be such a thing, such a fine-tuned thing, as a human brain, as an eye, and so forth? And the answer has to do with the structure of DNA. DNA is a long ladder of about a billion base pairs. Each base pair can be one of four possibilities. How many possibilities does that create? About 4 to the billion. 4 to the billion is a very, very, very big number. Of course, only a very small fraction of them led to viable life forms, and even a smaller fraction of that led to forms that could ask questions, but even a terribly small fraction of 4 to the billion is still a very, very large number. The landscape of possible biological designs is huge. That's what made everything work, and that's what made everything possible. Now, at the present time, cosmology and physics are beginning to ask very, very similar questions. Again, what is the reason that the universe turned out so fine-tuned? Some of us think the answer is very similar to the Darwinian answer. So, the first question is, is there such a thing as DNA for the universe? And according to modern, let me call it string theory, but maybe more broadly than string theory, the structure of the universe is determined by a kind of DNA, in many respects similar to biological DNA. What does that DNA have to do with? It has to do with the extra dimensions of space that string theory need. Now, just to explain to you very quickly about the extra dimensions of space, here I've imagined a world of one dimension. Creatures live in that one dimension. They can't pass each other. They live very restricted lives. But if they look at their world through a high-power microscope, they discover that it's really two-dimensional, that they live on a cylinder. And in fact, if they're small enough, they can move around in the other directions. That's all I'm going to say about what extra dimensions mean. But of course, what we have in mind is that the real world, space of the real world, represented in the lower figure here, also contains extra dimensions, so that anywhere in space, a small enough creature could move around in these extra dimensions. These extra dimensions are curled up and twisted up into tiny, tiny little manifolds, that's what they're called, which are basically pretzel-shaped, except much higher dimensional. On those pretzel shapes, well, you don't have salt, but you have other kinds of things that can decorate the pretzel shapes. They're called fluxes, D-brains, these kind of things and that kind of thing, which decorate these tiny, tiny, tiny little spaces that underlie physics at the smallest distances. These things which decorate the smallest possible distances are like the DNA of a universe. They determine what the properties of particles are, they determine the laws of physics, they determine the constants of nature. The space of these things is called the landscape. Just like the landscape of biological designs, you can think of it as the landscape of universe designs. It's an energy landscape. So, incidentally, is the biological landscape. It's an energy landscape where the valleys are the places of minimum energy ways of configuring these complicated pretzels, and those are the possible stable universes. How many of them are there in string theory? Well, nobody knows for sure. It doesn't seem like there's as many as there are biological life forms, potential biological life forms, but the number definitely appears to be bigger than 10 to the 500. That in itself is an enormous number. Given that there are so many possible universes, it's expected that there will be very, very many possibilities, not actual things, but possibilities within the narrow range. I'll call it Weinberg's window, which is what George referred to, the narrow range of possibilities where life can form. That's the basic idea of a landscape. Now, what is it that brought this landscape into existence as real things? That's a separate question. A landscape is a space of designs. The real world is the space of real things. It's like asking what made blueprints into houses. So I'm going to tell you now how some of us, cosmologists and physicists, think that the landscape turned into realities. Here I've drawn a picture of what could be called bubble nucleation. We have space, and at every point of space, the DNA of the universe is some particular form, pretzel shape, but all of a sudden, a little bubble forms. And in that little bubble, the DNA is a little bit different. Now, when I say DNA, of course, I don't mean DNA. I mean the DNA of string theory. It's a little bit different. If the bubble is very small, then it just shrinks back to nothing. But if the bubble is big enough in an expanding universe, in an inflating universe, if the bubble is big enough, by accident, if a big enough one forms, accident means quantum mechanical accident, then it will start to grow. Here is, roughly speaking, what one might expect, how one might expect the universe to evolve if this kind of picture of a very, very complicated landscape together with bubble nucleation makes sense. Now, most physicists do think each of the pieces makes sense. Here it goes. We start out with a blue universe. Let's see, let's go back for a step. We start out at the blue point. At the blue point, there's a bunch of excess energy, as you can see, because the altitude is somewhat above zero. That excess energy goes into expansion, rapid expansion, inflation. As it inflates, bubbles form. Bubbles with other DNA in them, other combinations of DNA. And as they expand, in fact, bubbles inside bubbles form. Notice the little black one inside the pink one. They keep growing and growing and growing. And inside the black one, more or less by accident, a little green one forms. In this way, you'll populate this entire landscape just as the tree of life populates the entire landscape of biological designs. That little green spot there happens to be a special place. It happens to be one of the few, very, very few places where life can exist. And that's where you are.
Thank you.
I think I was under 10 minutes.
You were under 10 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Sufkin. Now we will hear
you just throw my computer out the door or
from
no.
Professor Gross.
So, it's a pleasure to be here and to discuss this fascinating question. As you probably know from the material, I'm the one opponent, the conservative, who has to oppose my illustrious colleagues here who have advanced such an exciting hypothesis, which has brought you out in crowds. I'm amazed at the reaction to this topic. Clearly, people are fascinated by the idea of the anthropic principle for reasons that Vicky said. I noticed this when I found a lovely poem in the Nation, which was entitled The Anthropic Principle. And I want to share with you rapidly a few stanzas of this poem, which not only explain the anthropic principle almost as well as my colleagues, but convey a bit of my unease. So three drinks later, back in the office, I blast facts out my manifesto, which is simple. We should all relax. Apparently, no matter what we do, we already do our part. We balance the cosmological constant just by getting up in the morning and smacking around our wives. Isn't that amazing? And here's how it works according to the anthropic principle. There could be an infinity of universes, starry bubbles, burning balls, solid boxes of hard time. You name it, and they made it. Some are gelatinous, some are inside out, but there is one commonality. None are peopled. None have us. Only the composition of our universe allows for our existence. In fact, our presence is required, or the whole thing falls apart. So here's what I think. What if we all held our breath and stood sideways in a corner so we couldn't be found? Our universe would go wailing through the empty corridors of physics, knocking over furniture, searching for its vanished friends. And afterward, when we said, gotcha, and the universe wept with relief, we could all sit down for a nice cup of something comfy, have a heart-to-heart, and someone somewhere might wise up. This is Eleanor Lerman, please. Well, we've heard about the landscape, the basis, the reason that string theorists like Lenny and I are, or some string theorists like Lenny, are led to contemplate this very unfamiliar notion of anthropic arguments. The idea, as Lenny explained, is simple. Their string theory indicates, apparently, that there are lots of possible states that the universe or multiverse might find itself in. Universe A, with a large or not normal cosmological constant, we can't live there. And universe B, where we can. And perhaps the only reason we can pick out one of the many, if not infinite, universes is our existence. That's sort of the anthropic principle. So it's based on two things, as Lenny explained. One is that there exists a large number of universes, a multiverse, which within many or most of the fundamental parameters vary. And the ones that govern
our universe and are necessary for life are extremely rare.
And that seems to find some indication within string theory nowadays.
The other is the existence of a dynamical mechanism that populates the existence, that populates this ensemble of universes. So randomly chosen means nothing, but there has to be a process of that leads to one or many possibilities. And the anthropic principle assumes that there are many, many possibilities, perhaps picked out, as Lenny argued, by internal inflation, which has received, is a somewhat far out idea, but it has received some confirmation from the great success of inflation, inflationary theory. So this is the reason why string theorists have been led to this possibility. Many universes, very few are, could have life in them, in the universe, and therefore we are where we are, and we can't determine that except perhaps constrain that by assuming life must exist. But the vacua that they're talking about, the landscape, these possible universes are really not vacua. They're not nice places to live. Most are unstable and have a beginning which no one understands, with a Big Bang which is beyond our comprehension, and most have a future which we don't understand. None constitute a consistent cosmology, and our ability to even discuss their properties is extremely limited. The mechanism of eternal inflation necessary to populate this grand ensemble is even more shaky, both technically and conceptually. But it's even worse than that. The theory that we base all of this on, at least Lenny and I, string theory, which we are convinced is a step in the right direction, is incredibly incomplete. We don't really know what string theory is. If you ask Lenny in the question period, what is string theory? He will admit, I have no doubt, that he can't tell you what string theory is. We know things about it, but we don't know what it is. It might not even be a theory in the traditional sense, more of a framework. Something appears to be missing. A principle of symmetry, a dynamics, of consistency. After all, we're asking questions that physics, fundamental physics, has never had to ask before. Questions that used to be in the realm of religion, philosophy. How did the universe begin? What is the Big Bang? It is that, for that reason, and because we can't really formulate the theory, it's totally reasonable to assume that when we do so, when we supply perhaps the missing ingredients, that and answer the questions of the type, how did the universe begin, questions we're not even sure how you go about answering such a question, it seems to me as reasonable to assume that will produce a unique solution, not a vacuum, but a truly consistent space-time, a cosmology, which is the goal of quantum gravity, of string theory, of fundamental physics. What's the biggest problem standing in our way? Well, the fact that we have very few observations to rely on is certainly a big issue. But the biggest conceptual problem, I think most string theorists agree, has to do with the nature of quantum space-time, the nature of space-time when quantum mechanics plays a fundamental role, and this, the space-time itself fluctuates. And we believe and have strong evidence that, in fact, our classical traditional notions of space and time, even after relativity, are not fundamental. Most of the properties of space and time that even survive Einsteinian discussion are faulty in string theory. The concepts of topology, dimension, arbitrarily small distances, times. And we have many examples where we can already see how space is not a fundamental concept in string theory, and some or all of space emerges. And therefore suspect that we will have to, in order to have a fundamental formulation of string theory, get rid of space and time so that they will only be emerging concepts from something deeper which we don't know yet. That is very difficult. We have no examples yet of emergent time, and it's pretty hard to imagine a fundamental formulation of the laws of physics without time. But that might be necessary to construct a theory and understanding of the beginning of the universe, which is necessary to have a consistent picture of these ideas of how a multiverse might be created. Maybe that will allow us to strengthen and harden and get a theoretical framework in which we could be convinced of the existence of other universes, which we can never come in causal contact with. But in the absence of that, we could equally well imagine that a more traditional Einsteinian point of view will survive. As Einstein answered the question he asked, he stated, "Nature is constituted so that it is possible to lay down such strongly determined laws that within those laws only rationally completely determined constants occur, not constants that could be changed without completely destroying the theory." That's the traditional Einsteinian reductionist point of view, which I would not like to have to give up. But that's a belief. I mean, we might have to give it up. Physics might be environmental, as Lenny argues. But it's a dangerous road to go down. The prediction, so-called, of the anthropic principle on the principle itself are hard, if not impossible, to falsify, and often tautological, and often begin to smell of religion and philosophy, which isn't bad. Those are fine ways of asking questions, but they're not science. It goes against history. It is amazing. If you think about it, after only a few hundred years of study, we have been able to understand the entire normal observable world in terms of the standard model of elementary particle physics with very few parameters, and indeed, without having to resort to any anthropic principle fine-tuning or dialing. And indeed, if we look at the normal world around us, atomic physics, chemistry, and life, those we think we could understand in principle with only what we know and have verified, the principles of quantum mechanics, the existence of nuclei, electromagnetism, and one number that measures the strength of the electric force. 5. The anthropic principle is an easy way out. Its main conclusion, its main implication for physics is that we can't calculate certain things. They're determined environmentally. It also thrives on ignorance. Unlike other principles of physics, it grows weaker the more we know. So, since we're not sure what the final theory is and what the rules of the game in determining the universe are, since we suspect that space and time are emergent concepts and our understandings, especially because of that, of the foundations are shaky, we cannot claim to know the selection mechanism for the universe. And finally, just because we can't produce the solution is not evidence that it doesn't exist, and therefore, we should not give up. What strategy should we adopt? Well, the usual strategy of physics. Observe, experiment, and since the only way to defeat anthropic arguments, explaining some unexplainable parameter, is to calculate, calculate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Groves. Now we're going to move to the second part of this discussion. We're going to now go to a question and answer among the panel session. Each panelist, in an order they don't yet know, is going to be invited for 5 minutes to make additional statements and also pose a question to another panelist who can answer it. Now, panelists, you are welcome to stay in your seats and have your 5 minutes like that, or to go to the podium. It's entirely up to you. So I'd like to start because Professor Davies indicated he would like, he was very keen for that extra time. So let's start with Professor Davies. Please, you may have 5 minutes to make a rebuttal or a other kind of statement and ask a question of the panelists.
Does this work? Yes. I outlined three possible explanations for why the universe is bio-friendly, and I said I found them all wanting because they all appeal to something outside the universe which is unexplained. In the case of the unique final theory that David Gross was just outlining, you have to assume that that mathematical theory somehow already exists in some non-material platonic heaven, some realm of perfect mathematical forms and relationships, and that is there, as it were, even before the Big Bang. That has to exist independently of the universe. So that has to be accepted as a package of marvels that just happens to exist for no explanation. In the case of the multiverse, you have to not only assume the existence of all those other universes, but a universe-generating mechanism, and a whole host of other things like quantum mechanics and relativistic causality for that to work. So we need to, again, appeal to something, in fact, as many things outside the universe in order to explain what we see within it. And the theistic explanation, God did it, is really no explanation at all, because, again, it appeals to something outside the universe, an unexplained God, to make it happen. And so I've been toying with the idea that we should at least push as far as we can to an explanation for the bio-friendliness of the universe that comes from entirely within the universe. And this comes at a price, and the price is that we have to abandon the notion of the laws of physics as being absolute, eternal, universal, and immutable. I think that's an idea which is inherited from monotheistic theology, from which physics emerged about 300 or 400 years ago, the notion of a created world order that is fixed once and for all. It was enshrined by Newton in the fundamental dualism which lies at the heart of all science, the separation of laws and states. So according to Newton and everyone that has come subsequently, what happens in the universe is dependent intimately on the nature of physical laws, but the physical laws themselves care not one jot for what happens within the universe. So this deep asymmetry, I think, is an obstacle to ever coming up with an ultimate explanation for existence. It's only by abandoning that and have the notion that the laws are, as a theologian might say, immanent rather than transcendent, that we have a chance of getting to grips with this. So I've been trying to develop a model in which the laws emerge, co-emerge with the universe, so that physical law, mathematics, life and observers are all co-explanatory in a self-synthesizing loop. If this sounds familiar to some of my physics colleagues, it's because it's not new. These ideas were espoused by John Wheeler a long time ago, and have been resurrected with a new view of the nature of physical law, which is that we think of the laws of physics not as these transcendent, immutable mathematical statements, instead of thinking of there being a sort of infinite warehouse of handy mathematical forms that Mother Nature plunders and plucks out a few choice ones in order to characterize the physical laws. Rather than thinking that way, we think instead of the laws of physics as like a program being run on the great cosmic machine. They're like software, and the hardware is the universe itself. And when you come to that point of view, with the laws and the stuff of the universe being interdependent, this abandon this fundamental dualism that goes back to Newton, then I think we have an opportunity for a self-consistent, self-explanatory system that will include the existence of life and observers. So seeing as I was supposed to ask a question, I can ask it of all my panelists, because I've suggested to you a new way, a fourth way, of looking at how we explain the biofriendliness of the universe, the Goldilocks enigma, and it's based on this particular revision of how we think about physical law. So I'd like to ask my fellow panelists, where do you think the laws of physics come from? Are they a package of marvels that just happen to be without any explanation or reason, or can you explain them? Over to you.
So you're not you are asking the entire panel this question, basically.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. In that case, why don't we start with what Professor Susskind? Why don't you tackle that question?
I don't have an answer to it. May I have my 5 minutes? 3 minutes.
Okay, in a moment you'll have your 5 minutes. So let's perhaps Professor Gross would like to tackle that question.
I think this was a good illustration of the dangers of anthropic principle. I'm often asked when I give talks and, you know, get excited and talk about the possibility of a theory of everything, although I'm not sure such a thing really could exist. Well, why is there something rather than nothing, which is similar to what Paul asked. And I make it clear that at every point in science, there are questions that are scientific or part of science are susceptible to observation, experiment, and calculation, and there are those that are not. And there are many more in the larger set. Many fascinating ones, many ones I wonder about, but they're not science. And as science has progressed, the set of questions that are not science has indeed grown smaller and maybe will vanish someday, but it is my strong feeling, which I imagine is Lenny's as well, which is why he didn't answer it, is that this is not yet the time for this kind of question. Maybe its time will come someday, but I don't think it's addressable by either observation, experiment, or calculation. And it's not science. And one of my problems with the anthropic principle is that once you start invoking principles of that type, it's often difficult then to draw the line between what is science and what is not.
So it's a mystery.
There are many mysteries, not all of which we will solve in our lifetime.
Never, never, never give up.
You're welcome.
Professor Astafi, would you like to comment or try to answer that question?
Well, I really agree with David's remarks. As the audience probably realized, that I'm much more on the experimental side of things than my other colleagues on the panel. So the sort of things that I'm interested in are really, you know, what can we learn observationally? And it's not inconceivable. I mean, string theory, there is very little observational evidence for string theory. Is it possible to get observational evidence for higher dimensional physics? The answer is that it may well be possible. We don't know that we can do it. We'd have to be lucky. But it's possible. So it's worthwhile doing experiments to see whether something that beyond our paradigm, our current paradigm, shows up. And, you know, that is the way that we make progress in science. It's not through speculation. It's through a mixture of theory with observational guidance.
Are you satisfied with those answers?
Yes, very satisfied. Thank you.
Okay. So then, since you were so polite in asking, Professor Susskind, why don't you have the next 5 minutes to make some additional statements and also pose a question to someone on the panel or to the whole panel, if you like.
If I were to try to leave a particular impression in this audience about this controversy, the impression I would like to leave is that there really is no real controversy. There are only questions. The questions that I'm talking about are not these incredibly deep ones about why there is something rather than nothing, but questions which I hope can be answered within the next 20, 30, 40 years, maybe 10 years, maybe even 2 years, I don't know. Let me give you just an example of some of the questions which, if we understood them better, I think there would be less of a controversy. The first thing, which David didn't even mention, is there really this incredible landscape of string theory? Does that really exist? There are mathematical reasons to believe that it does, but none of the mathematics is sufficiently rigorous that we can be certain that it's right. That, I think, is a question that string theorists and mathematicians and theoretical physicists can answer. I don't know how long it will take, but it will be answered. Next question. Is the idea of eternal inflation really a mathematically consistent idea? I showed you what it was. It was this bubble nucleation. Most physicists subscribe to the individual elements, but what comes out at the end is so odd and so different than anything we ever imagined that it really should be subjected to mathematical scrutiny at the highest level. Let me tell you, the mathematics is extremely rickety. And so these are questions which I think can, another issue, anthropic ideas are always probabilistic. You're always asking questions like, given the existence of life, what's the probability that the cosmological constant or the Higgs mass or something else lies in a certain interval? And then you try to make predictions based on statistics. Well, we haven't got the vaguest clue how to think about probabilities on this landscape. And this has gotten serious. People have tried very hard to figure it out, how to think about a probability measure, and they don't know. There are, of course, all the questions of empirical confirmation. I don't think I can even begin to get into those. The last question, which David correctly points to, is there an alternative theory of the cosmological constant? Some bright young person, probably a lot younger than either of us, could come along tomorrow and say, no, look, here's this mathematical equation. The root of that equation is the cosmological constant, and amazingly, it's 1 part in 10 to the 100, or 120, excuse me. That could happen. So far, it doesn't look likely, but it could happen. And as David said, we must not give up that avenue of exploration. I see no reason to give it up, and I see no reason not to pursue two lines of question at the same time. Finally, one objection I do have to what David said is, I will summarize it this way, all great ideas are always dangerous to somebody.
There wasn't a clear question, but that didn't sound like a clear question, but it sounds like you want to answer it, so let's hear from you.
I want to answer it in two ways. First, one of the clear, as you must have gathered by now, the big number or incalculable question behind much of this that leads to the anthropic principle and one of the great discoveries of astrophysics is this cosmological constant, the energy density in the vacuum. And it is true that naive estimates, which are very general, are off by 120 orders of magnitude. But it's not really 120 orders of magnitude. It's more like 60. 60 of those are easily gotten. And it's not really 60 orders of magnitude. It's an energy density. So if we usually measure it in units of energy, as we usually do in physics, it's 15 orders of magnitude. Now, that's still a big number. But we have already, in our lifetime, explained a number that is bigger, which is 10 to the 20. It is a number that Dirac once posed as an incredible coincidence that has a deep, deep explanation. Why is our protons so much lighter than the scale of gravity? It's the hierarchy between gravity and you. What makes you up are protons and neutrons in your nuclei. Well, I'm proud to say that the theory that my colleagues and I developed of the strong interactions with the whole community of the strong nuclear force has answered that problem. We now have a pretty good understanding of why the proton mass is 10 to the 20 times lighter than the scale of gravity. Essentially, the nuclear force is very weak at very high energies where gravity is strong. And it only grows stronger at its scales, since it varies so slowly, of 10 to the 20 times bigger. The way we calculate a number of order 10 to the 20 is that the effects are logarithmic. So we really only have to calculate the log of 10 to the 20, which is about 20. That's a trick, you think, but it's the way physics works, and we understand it quantitatively. So it isn't true at all that we have not been able to explain, in fact, in the last 30 years, a number of the order of 10 to the 20, which taken to the fourth power again, the energy density inside nuclei compared to the energy, the natural prediction is 10 to the 80. And the cosmological constant, in fact, if we believe certain things like supersymmetry, is smaller.
So the problem is not so much that it's 10 to the 120. It's that we don't have an idea of how to calculate it, a strategy, a mechanism, a model. If we did, and we, you know, Lenny probably would be working on how to get the actual number. And it is always dangerous, my opinion is always dangerous at any given point in time, based on what we know and the ideas we have, to conclude that we won't have the ideas that will be necessary to solve a tough problem. And since we're asking these totally new kinds of questions, and we're faced with a theory we're working on a theory we don't truly understand, which has all sorts of conceptual problems, it seems to me likely that we're missing something that will make the solution of that problem as easy as to answer Dirac's conundrum about the 10 to the 20. The question I wanted to ask, no, I'm not, it's not my turn yet, that's the answer.
Since Professor Susskind did not pose a question to any specific panel, I just want to make sure, would either of you like to address what Professor Susskind said before I give you your official 5 minutes for a discussion? No, okay. So Professor Estafia, why don't you take your 5 minutes now and ask a question of the panelists.
So in my 10 minutes, I showed this diagram.
5 minutes.
No, in my 10 minutes, right? This is the 5 minute slot, okay? So, but you've got to add another 30 seconds to get into the job. So in my 10 minute slot, I showed this diagram. So this represents the multiverse that Lenny talked about. And we don't understand how this works. And this view graph was a schematic representation of the anthropic arguments of that we populate this landscape and clearly we'd select regions where life is possible as plausible universes. Now mathematically, we would write those two pictures as pictorial representations for what we're actually doing in terms of the rules of probability theory. So F of P there is the probability distribution that we observe parameters of particular values, the cosmological constant and so on. The distribution of the landscape gives us the prior distribution of the parameters, and then the F selection is the probability distribution that certain parameters can sustain life. And that's just the rules of probability theory. The difficulty and one of the big problems, one of the reasons that the anthropic principle is controversial, is that we don't know how to calculate F prime. In the eternal inflation scenario, universes are cheap. They're too cheap. There are an infinite number of them. And we don't know how to regularize these infinities to calculate a prior distribution. If you can't calculate the prior distribution, you can't calculate anything. Okay? So when people have applied the anthropic principle, they've made assumptions about what that prior distribution is. The F selection part is relative. You can address that. With reasonable assumptions that most people would sign up to. You're not going to form intelligent life unless the universe has certain properties. So you would imagine that you would need stars, you would certainly need atoms, you'd need stars, and so on. And so that is really astrophysics, to calculate that component. Now, I have two questions, actually, if you'll allow me. One is to Lenny about the problems with this prior distribution. What are our prospects of actually getting an understanding of the measure in this multiverse, which is a fundamental problem. And unless we solve that problem, we can't calculate things anthropically. The second question is to David. the never give up philosophy in its extreme form would say that there is no role for this F selection. That means that this prior distribution has to be a delta function around a certain set of parameters. Now, if there is no role for selection, then to me, it's incredibly mysterious that the prior is a delta function around a set of parameters that sustains life. That is a very strange, strange possibility, strange solution. And so, and it smacks of creationism. So I would like to ask David whether he would be worried if that F prior was a selection, a delta function.
Okay, why don't we attack the first question first, Professor Seskin?
Yeah. Well, I think George asked a very hard question. It was one of the questions on my list. And I don't know the answer. It was the question of how close are we or can we expect to be able to understand probability distributions on the landscape. The problem is a very famous mathematical problem that the number of bubble universes comes out infinite, and in fact the number of every kind comes out infinite. And probabilities are ratios, but they're ratios of infinity divided by infinity, and that means they're simply undefined. Now, this is not the first time physics has faced problems of infinities, and always somebody eventually figures out how to, George used the word, regulate the infinities. Regulating the infinities means doing something that makes the infinities finite, and then calculating the ratio, and then undoing what you did to make it finite, but hopefully that the ratios stay fixed. The answer is now a lot of people are struggling to find that way of doing things. Andre Linde, Alex Valenkin, and many, many others. And I would have to say, simply without great success. That's an honest appraisal of the situation, and that's what makes me most nervous about this whole situation. That's what makes me, to some extent, agree with David that we can't and certainly should not give up other avenues of approach. I think it would be a disaster if every young person sort of bought into these ideas just because three of us so-called eminent scholars buy into this. It would be a very bad thing. So I'm finished. That's it.
Okay, Professor Gross, the delta function question.
To answer you, it's somewhat total. I mean, this is one of the reasons I have such a problems with the anthropic principle used as it is for life, which, notice, Lenny luckily never mentioned. Life, I don't, you know, I'm not sure what life is. Define life. Life is, we're beginning to understand, is evolves naturally, and it's at some point complex enough, naturally selected biochemical process will exhibit something we call consciousness. Does life require consciousness? I don't think the universe, I think the point of view that we look at the universe and say it's finely tuned for life is extraordinarily anthropocentric. And doesn't teach us anything about physics, or about science. Think, for example, about the properties of water, which are necessary. You know, if ice melted, it was heavier than water, than the solid form of water was heavier than the liquid form, as is true for most substances, life would never have formed on this planet. Biologists tell me the oceans would have been frozen sheets of ice. There would be no place for life as we know it to form. We can explain water, as you know, with ordinary theory of atomic physics, which, as I explained, involves one free parameter, fine structure constant. We understand how that emerges. I see no reason from the existence of life to doubt that we could have a theory that explained, in some sense, all parameters, all phenomena in nature that are necessary, so-called, for the existence of life. Could they have been different? The moment we have the ability to dial them, because we don't understand enough, as we did 100 years ago with all of atomic physics and chemistry, because we didn't understand enough, and now we're not allowed to dial them. If they had been different in some hypothetical universe, maybe we would not have existed, but who says that complex or phenomena of some kind would not have existed? And if you can give me a definition of life consistent with what we know about biology at an abstract sense that differentiates it from an arbitrarily complex inanimate system, biologists would be very interested.
Okay. And any panelists? Professor Davies, did you want to say anything? I got the impression you were thinking a little bit about if I read you wrong.
Haven't we used up our time?
That's okay. We have the last panelist to give us 5 minutes. Yeah, you can have a minute. I sensed you wanted to say something.
Just to make the point that, of course, David is quite right, that we've been talking about life as we know it, but the conditions that go to make that up are very, very broad. George has drawn attention to the fact we're really only talking about the existence of atoms and the existence of large-scale structure like galaxies and stars. And so it's not inconceivable there'd be some other regions of parameter space that might permit life. But even if that's so, the issue is if you've got some multi-dimensional parameter space that life as we know it would seem to occupy a rather small region of that, but there could be other regions which could permit observers to have these sorts of discussions. So long as these regions are isolated, then you're still stuck with the same problem, I think.
Okay, the last panelist to have his 5 minutes is actually Professor Gross.
I think in my answers I've covered most of my comments. I'll ask Paul Davies, who is the strongest, seemingly, convictions here about the anthropic principle, or maybe Lenny could chip in. So is it true that the only way to falsify the anthropic principle as a principle to be applied to physics is, and I don't mean a particular application of the anthropic principle to answer a particular question, but the principle. Is it true that the only way to falsify the principle is to calculate everything?
See, Lenny's ready with an answer, so I'll let you go first.
I mean, I would like to falsify it, and I'd like an easier road.
Okay. My feeling is, yeah, you're right. The anthropic principle is just too diffuse a thing. There's a package which is on the table now. The package which is on the table is the string theory landscape and eternal inflation. That's a combination that I do think can be falsified. For example, if we were to measure the curvature of the universe and find it was positive, that would certainly throw a monkey wrench in many of the ideas of eternal inflation. So I that's right. I think it is much too broad or diffuse an idea. The other thing you asked about was the use of life in all of this kind of argument. And I agree with you. We shouldn't have kept away from the use of life in the argument. I think the real question, I forgot who used the word patchwork. Patchwork quilt? Yeah, I like that term.
That's your term. I got it from you.
Yes or no? I think the real issue on the table, we know the universe is much bigger than the portion we can see. We know there's a cosmic horizon that we can't see beyond. So we know it's very, very, very big. Just how big, we don't know. But what we don't know, given that it is very, very big, whether it's very, very big and all homogeneous and all the same, with the same laws of nature perhaps being determined by some basic mathematical principle, or if it is a diverse universe. It's just too big for us to tell now. And I think that's what it comes down to. Both of these things are conjectures. Both of them are conjectural and equally hard to verify. So there's two conjectures out there, as far as I can tell. The universe is very big and all the same and determined by some unique set of rules about particle physics, or the universe is very big and diverse with a lot of different properties. And some of those places are not going to be conducive to at least our kind of life. And we can dismiss those as possible places where we can live. That's what I mean by the anthropic principle, and very little more at the present time.
Right. Now I've had a chance to think about it, the answer. If we take the weak anthropic principle, which is really what we've been talking about mostly, then you can apply that in fairly mundane ways. For example, why are we living on the surface of a planet when the vast majority of the universe is near empty space? We're in an atypical location. That seems to be a very reasonable application of this principle. I don't like the word anthropic, but it's biophilic selection effect or something. Could we falsify that? Well, we could if we found that outer space was teeming with life and that there isn't anything terribly special about life on the surface of this planet. If we go to the so-called strong anthropic principle, which is what I was hinting at in the fourth way, where there would be some deep connection between the emergence of life and consciousness and the nature of physical law, then I think yes, because to make that connection specific, there would have to be a number of predictions, and indeed I've stuck my neck out and made a number of predictions having to do with treating the laws of physics as in terms of information and computer programs and so on, given that the great cosmic machine that this software is being run on is a machine of finite resources, and therefore I think there would be observable effects that would go with that. So that it is possible that it could be falsified by looking for those effects.
Okay, I think at this point we're going to move to the open question session. We have, first of all, we have two questions, two special questions from members of the audience who I believe are here. Mr. Bernier, who is the director of the Newman Center, I'd like to start with you. For the open questions, I'd just like to ask people to keep their questions to within, one or 2 minutes at most. And please, the microphones for the people asking their questions. Oh, yes, okay, yes. Okay, first question, please.
Professor Susskind and Gross, both of you alluded to Leibniz's question, why is there something rather than nothing? And you said that it was a profound question that we may never answer. Is there any way that we can explore this question, or is it a question that's meaningless, or that an impious question that good scientists shouldn't ask themselves?
And first approximation, yes. From the point of view of a physicist, it's ill-formulated. What is nothing? Define nothing. You know, maybe something came, I don't know what something is, I don't know what nothing is. I mean, it's not something, not a well-defined question from a physicist's point of view, one indeed, therefore, thereby susceptible to either observation, experiment, or calculation, which is what we do. Try to do. It might become one, but we're clearly not there yet. And so, you know, leave it to philosophers. Philosophers have retreated from addressing the questions that we're interested in as we've encroached on their field. And what is life? Was a question that 200 years ago was unanswerable and obviously interesting to ask, and people did. And they came up with all sorts of answers. I don't think it was very fruitful, most of those discussions. We didn't have enough. I always say we didn't have enough knowledge to be intelligently ignorant. We're all ignorant of why there is something rather than nothing, but I don't think we know enough to ask the question correctly.
Okay. The second special question will be asked by Dr. Margaret Somerville, who is the director from McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law.
Thank you. Listening to this discussion tonight, I think we can say that the underlying theme is questions, which ones we ask and what we do with the answers. There's a saying in ethics that there's no such thing as a neutral question. And I'm just wondering what you think about why we've seen this huge conflict in this debate, in that the public definitely perceives this as a conflict between science and religion. And I would like to ask you whether you think that that might be because there's fundamentalism on both sides, in that scientists see science as the only valid way of knowing, and religious people often tend to see religion as the only valid way of knowing. And would you accept that there are multiple ways of human knowing, and it's very important that we define which kind of, both which kind of knowing we want to apply to a certain issue. For instance, if we apply science, we get scientific answers, but that doesn't necessarily disqualify the answers that come from other ways of knowing.
Okay, thank you. Professor Davies, would you like to answer that question?
I think it's clear that the four panelists here, or five, I guess, in total, this evening are coming at these problems from a scientific point of view. And in my preamble, I said that these age-old questions of existence have been the province of priests and philosophers. They're now part of science. And so it's not surprising that we are bringing scientific techniques to bear on them. And the question is that the whole story? Are there other ways of knowing? The special way of scientific inquiry is that we can investigate things and make them public. They can be presented. The evidence in favor of a particular point of view can be laid out in public as we're doing here. And as we've discussed, although some of these problems are tough, it's not inconceivable that we could come back in another 20 years and some of them may have been resolved to everybody's satisfaction. So the method of science is to make available evidence that can be independently checked by a skeptic who may take a different point of view. My understanding of a religious way of knowing, a religious experience, is that it's a private experience, which may be very deep and meaningful to the person who has that experience, but is of no real help to somebody who hasn't had that experience. It's a very different type of knowledge. And it's perfectly clear that in answer to Margaret Somerville's question, that yes, of course, there are other ways of knowing. To take a trivial example, when I have dreams, I have experiences that are very real to me, completely outside of anyone else's experience. It's part of my experience, and they're certainly, my dreams are not scientific, although I will just tell you that from time to time I do experience these things called lucid dreams, and in a lucid dream, it's quite unlike the usual wishy-washy dream where all the laws of physics have gone to pot. When a physicist has a lucid dream, it's an extraordinary experience, because in this dream, it's as if you get the full technicolor reality. And just recently, and it can show you that the dream person can be smarter than the waking person, because I had a lucid dream a few weeks ago in which I had the presence of mind in the dream to look in a mirror to see if the image was a mirror image. In other words, did the dream actually respect the laws of physics? And it did. And then, what about this one? In a subsequent lucid dream just a few weeks later, I was in conversation with a philosopher. And I said to this philosopher, you must understand that I, the dream Paul Davies, am not real. I am not a real person. So I was trying to talk to this dream philosopher, convincing the dream philosopher that the dream Paul Davies wasn't real. So all of this discourse is in a sort of universe outside of scientific inquiry, I suppose, and it's part of my reality, and so I would be very reluctant to say that Paul Davies the scientist is the only reality that there is. So I leave open the idea there could be something else.
Okay, thank you very much. Other questions from the audience now? I guess you do. Please go ahead.
Leonard, you guys seem to suggest that three solutions to the problem is actually calculating what the cosmological constant numbers to exist, but that we can't actually ever find.
Because we're too dumb?
Well, like, suppose one example is if we take a look at prime number distribution, there does exist a number where the sort of, like, number of primes exceeds the, like, logarithmic integral for whatever. You know what I'm talking about, though, right? The prime number. I'm just saying that from a mathematical point of view, can there exist numbers that just exist but can't be calculated? And so just because we can't calculate it, we can't dismiss their existence. Does that make any sense? I don't know.
Okay. Thank you for your question. Would you like to answer that, Professor Sussman?
Well, would I like to? Boy, would I like to. My guess is that that given any given setup, given any given set of any given genome for the universe, any particular Calabi-Yau compactification, any particular set of fluxes, any particular set of DNA, in other words, my guess is that in principle, with a great deal of effort, we could calculate the cosmological constant for that particular setup. The problem is, at least in my view, and in the view of people who are like-minded myself, the number of possibilities is going to be so great that it doesn't help you very much to calculate it for any specific possibility. Now, David has another view. I would like to remark about something that David said. David correctly said that physics has, in the past, calculated some very, very small numbers. In particular, he calculated some very, very small numbers. No. This was a marvelous triumph of physics in 1973 or whatever it was, when David and his colleagues put together a theory which you can think of, when everything's said and done, is why is gravitation so incredibly weak? That's one way of saying what they did. It's not the way they said it, but that is the way they said it. As soon as people, they didn't say it that way. That's the way I'm saying it. But as soon as people saw the mechanism that they invented, the first thing they said, and this was, you know, more than 30 years ago, let's try that for the cosmological constant. And for more than 30 years, people have been trying and trying and trying and coming gradually to the conclusion that there is no opening there, that that is not the mechanism. Now, could it be? We haven't looked hard enough? Sure. But in the meantime, we're exploring another avenue, and I don't see what's wrong with that. I'm not sure why David's dander up so much about it, frankly.
Okay, other questions? Question right there, yeah.
Yes, good evening. Given that your science is beginning to speak the language of religion and philosophy, I guess there's no avoiding the question of consciousness in your understanding of the universe. What is the role of consciousness? Is it a simple byproduct of existence? Is it one of its fundamentals? Is it a simple tool only to understand the universe? And is it time to start including it into our scientific understanding of the universe and somehow related to the formulae which we use? Or is it possible at all? Thank you.
Anybody who wants to?
One remark again. Questions like that. Consciousness. If you talk to neuroscientists, consciousness is an illusion. And consciousness is something they're working hard to try and understand scientifically. And you talk as if consciousness is something we all understand what it means. It's, again, a very ill-formulated question. Although there are people, indeed, who will, Paul is one, who, as he said, will, as Johnny Wheeler did years ago, try to connect the very structure of the universe to the existence of consciousness, whatever that is.
Yeah, I'd like to say a few words, because I do take consciousness seriously, and I take life seriously, and it's true that these are slippery things to define, but I think we know consciousness when we see it. But for me, the significant thing is not that we can observe the world. We've been talking about this anthropic selection, that we are observers and therefore selecting from some ensemble, etc. For me, the most significant thing has always been not that we can watch the show, but that we can also understand the plot. That is, through science and mathematics, we've unraveled the cosmic code, the secret tune to which nature dances. And the fact that human beings can not just observe the universe, but understand it, at least in part, I think is a fact of tremendous significance. Now, it tends to be shrugged aside by scientists because you can't be a scientist without assuming, as an act of faith, that the universe is not only intelligible, not only ordered, but intelligible to us. You just wouldn't embark on science if you felt we couldn't understand it. And so it's sort of taken as the starting point for science. When you stand back to think about it, what an astonishing thing that we human beings are able, at least in part, to actually unlock the secrets of nature, unravel what's going on, and this hidden subtext of nature, which we call the laws of physics, is something that we've been able to tap into. And it seems to me to shrug that aside as just a trivial little accident, it's surplus to requirements. We can imagine a universe in which life emerged as a trivial embellishment, as a byproduct of no significance, and in which even observers arise as a byproduct of no significance. But if in addition to that we can come to understand the universe, we can put our finger, as it were, on the mental pulse of the cosmos, I think that is such a stupendously important and significant fact that it seems to me that if we're to give a complete explanation for existence, including our own existence, we've got to take it into account. But obviously, this is a philosophical point of view. I think taking consciousness seriously is something that I've always done. That's what I feel comfortable with. I can't prove to you that it's not just a stupendous fluke, that not only has there arisen life and not only has there arisen conscious life, but there has arisen beings who can actually comprehend the universe. And had I had the time to go to the last slide on my initial presentation, I would have ended with a quote from Einstein, which said, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible." And I heartily agree, and I think we cannot ignore that fact.
Before we move to the next question, Professor Gross, do you have a comment you want to make?
I do want to counter this kind of argument. I find it interesting why people are so astounded by the fact that we, who are part of and created by the universe, according to processes we understand better and better, should have, it should be such a mystery why have emerged as creatures or as complex processes that can understand the universe from which it was created. After all, it's partly how we were selected and constructed by natural selection and evolution. Mathematics, Wigner said, is unreasonably effective. Well, that's hardly surprising. Mathematics is a language, in which we describe reality, and we are a natural process evolved to, among the rest, understand the universe. It's hardly surprising. It's almost tautological, as is much of this.
I think that's a terrible confusion of the physical and mental realms. It's mixing two levels. The fact that the brain has emerged as a result of mathematical laws of physics in no way at all connects with the fact that the human mind is able to comprehend the world through that same mathematics.
Some of us think that the human mind is nothing more than electrical signals and neurons and is indistinguishable from the human brain.
Well, I would say that doesn't answer my point, because even if it was an epiphenomenon, nevertheless, we're talking about a level of description and a level of complexity with mental processes which are connected hardly at all with the fundamental processes underlying it, by which I mean that the fact that an electron in your brain might move in compliance with the Dirac equation or something in no way would explain why stupendous numbers of electrons, electrons and other electrochemical activity can resonate with, which is the best way I can explain or describe how we come to understand the world, resonate with the laws that apply out there in the universe, say in the quantum realm or the realm of black holes or something of that sort. I just don't see that there's any direct connection whatever, even if mind is just an epiphenomenon.
Okay, I think we should move on and let some other audience members ask questions.
Is Dr. Gross suggesting maybe a misunderstanding of Darwinism, that Darwinism was directed towards us, like we are somehow the height of evolution?
Are you asking me?
Well, yes, you made some comments on a directional aspect of evolution that's worrisome to the argument.
I wasn't referring to the... There could very well be I think actually there is a directional... It's true that the theory of evolution, the idea, does not require directionalism, but the evolution of more complex systems clearly is a historical trend in the one life system we have evidence for, and it might very well be more general. That doesn't mean that evolution was designed to produce us, and we, of course, are, I am sure we are the missing link in any case. I mean, we're not the end of evolution, just a link along the way. And we have very little understanding of what it means to comprehend, which you take as such a mystery, or to even be conscious. And much of it, as far as I understand, is somewhat a epiphenomenon, not sure is the right word, but a very crude description of what's really going on up here.
Okay, another question?
I have one. Thank you very much. Over here?
Oh, yes, okay.
I'm going to express myself in English. First of all, I just would like to thank all the four for your presentation. I have a question. My question is based basically on the entropic principle. Well, I think actually it was mentioned the fact that it is, basically you said that the constant, all right, the constant must carry this value, otherwise life will not be possible. Now, my question is due to the fact that, I mean, when we're in school, basically we try to teach students to think critically. And my question is due to the fact that how that can be critical thinking, in the sense that there's a parallel, for instance, in biology, where the probability that a protein formed by chance is 1 out of 10 to the power of 113. And as a mathematician, we know that when an event has a probability of 1 over 10 to the power of 15, is not even possible. And also to the fact when we go to the physics, the four fundamental forces are well tuned. There's such a precision that without the weak nuclear force, or whether it's the electromagnetic force, if it was too strong, chemical bonds would not be possible. So we tend to say on the entropic principle that the value must have, the constant must have the value, otherwise won't be possible. I think that...
What is your question?
My question is basically... How can this be critical thinking? And second, Professor Ross was honest enough scientifically to say that in the entropic, it's like an easy way out, in the sense that theories in stream doesn't understand fully the topic. So how come we need to wait? Okay, we need to wait. Let's see a conference like this to the public to be informed and whatever. And it is presented in the book such as it was like a fact. So I don't know if my guest, the speaker, understand the question. Or I need to restate it myself in French.
Would someone like to tackle that question?
Briefly, in summary, how is this critical thinking? And I have the impression that scientists tend to present the science subjectively, whereas science should be supposed to be based on empirical facts.
Okay, thank you. Professor F. Staffy, would you like to tackle that one?
Well, I think if we could calculate those two probability distributions that I showed on my view graph, then we'd have a proper theoretical framework in which we could apply the anthropic principle. The problem is that we can't calculate the prior distribution.
Okay, we have time for a question. We have a young woman in a green sweater who's been waiting very patiently. We get the. Just wait for the microphone, please. Yeah, it's coming. It's coming. It's on its way.
I just wanted to say that I think most of us would probably all agree with Dr. Crossan that the Anthropic principle is empirically sketchy, if you will. But honestly, doesn't it look great on that sign there? We've been able to draw out a community of about, 700 people here, and we're all learning about physics principles that I probably would not have Wikipedia'd if I'd gone home tonight. And so, for the very first time ever, I got to see Dr. George, I can't pronounce your last name, show me the universe expanding in an observable sense, which is, until now, I thought was more theoretical math that hadn't really been addressed.
Your question.
So, okay, question. Two questions. Would you agree with the definition, Dr. Cross, of life being something that reproduces itself? So even if a universe was able to reproduce itself, then that would be a universe that was alive, which I think is what they presented in Men in Black. But honestly, that's not really the point. The point is reproducible being the key definition and not necessarily having to be different in a system from, life as differentiated from another system, which could be something else reproducing itself. But I think ultimately, I see that as a large definition.
Okay.
Normally, when people invoke the Anthropic principle try to make some kind of semi-quantitative arguments, by life they mean observers like us, people who ask these questions. So if we're not around to ask the questions, then the question can't be asked. So we're around to ask. That's what they talk, where they really mean mostly by life. In Lenny's internally inflating landscape, multiverse, the universes do indeed self-reproduce, and their children look very different than themselves. Right?
Yes.
But that's not life. Right. And universes don't observe themselves, it seems, without life, whatever.
These are words. You can define life, if you want to define life as something which reproduces, then universes are alive. These are words. These are words you can use the way you want to use them. But frankly, I doubt that there's any other particular similarities between living creatures and universes. So, no, I wouldn't say they were alive. I think it's not hard to imagine completely inanimate objects that do absolutely nothing except reproduce themselves. And you would have no real reason to think of them as alive.
Crystals reproduce themselves, they're not living. You need reproduction, variation, and selection. You need the whole Darwinian game, I think, to make life.
Okay, we have time for one more question from the audience. There's one way in the back. Yeah, right there with the microphone.
All right. I deal with evolution education quite a bit, and we've kind of touched on evolution a little bit and a little bit of something smacking of creationism. So I'm wondering, since creationists tend to argue that certain principles in physics deny evolution or say that it's impossible, since we have such illustrious physicists here, I'd like to know if the Anthropic principle or if the second law of thermodynamics has in any way, in your experience, denied the possibility of evolution.
It's true that some physicists in the past have argued that evolution, that ordinary physics could not explain evolution or life even. A great physicist, my colleague at Princeton for years, Eugene Wigner, wrote a paper 2 years before DNA was discovered in which he proved that there had to be, physics could not explain life because of thermodynamic fluctuations and the impossibility of transmitting that as much information as you'd need to specify the structure of a cell in a reproducing over many generations. He didn't know about, you know, the mechanisms that repair DNA. So knowing enough chemistry and not having the imagination to think of new mechanisms, he proved that you need extra physical laws to explain life. It's a wonderful example, which I think bears some similarity to today. When you don't know, you don't have the answer, the mechanism, the model, the scenario for explaining something, you sometimes lead, you know, jump to drastic conclusions instead of just admitting that you don't know yet the answer. But to come back to your original question, at the moment, I know of no physicist who, or any reason in physics that contradicts quite the opposite, natural selection and evolution.
Okay, well, we want to reserve the last question in the question and answer period for Mr. Lauren Trache, who's a...
Okay, well, I don't want to be unfair. I'm going to go to lunch with you guys after. But anyway, thank you very much for letting me ask a question here. So the question is, Alan Guth, who's the father of the widely accepted inflation model of the Big Bang, has said that the universe is the ultimate free lunch. I checked that in Google today, and he definitely said that. What does he mean by this? To me, it seems to imply that the universe was created ex nihilo, in other words, out of nothing. So can you explain this concept, and how is this compatible with Einstein's law of the conservation of mass energy?
Professor Susskind,
what Alan Guth was referring to was the ability of space to, let's say, clone itself by the process of inflation. For inflation, which means exponential expansion, to just go on and on and on, reproducing more and more volumes of space to infinity. I would say that free lunch, well, let me first say about the free lunch. I would say that free lunch is possibly the source of some of the great discomfort that, that George and I were talking about these infinities, and that we don't understand how to calculate probabilities because everything is infinite over infinite. There's just too much of a free lunch. And that is very troubling, that inflation and expansion can just go on endlessly, 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 producing more and more and more of the same until there's just an infinite amount of everything. That, I think, is a very dangerous idea. I think dangerous in the sense that it's likely to be wrong. On the other hand, we don't know why it's wrong. What was the other question that you asked? It was a good one. I can't remind me. Okay. This is a sort of misconception that, well, I don't know if it's a misconception, but it's a thing that keeps coming up whenever you talk to lay people about these kind of things. Energy in the general theory of relativity is a funny thing. It's always zero. Now, the way it's always zero, how can anything be conserved or be interesting if it's always zero? Well, it can stay zero, but various kinds of energy can go back and forth from one kind to another. So when the universe expands, there's a trade-off from a kind of kinetic energy which has to do with the expansion rate on the one hand, and potential energy, which is the dark energy that just sits there and doesn't have to do with expansion. So as the universe expands in the general theory of relativity, it's not that energy is created from nowhere. The dark energy, the increasing amount of dark energy, is compensated for by a decrease in certain negative kinetic energies. So there's no violation of the law of energy in having a free lunch. What's troubling about it is it just seems a little bit too free. You know, it's as though you generated an infinite number of ham sandwiches and an infinite number of peanut butter sandwiches and an infinite number of sardine sandwiches and an infinite number of every kind of sandwich you could think of, and then you tried to decide which sandwich do I want most. I mean, there's just too many of them to make any sense out of it. And that, to me, is what's most troubling about these ideas of eternal inflation. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Paul, you had something.
Well, I think Lenny covered it pretty much, except he didn't mention the magic thing about the negative pressure of the vacuum, which is what balances the books, because as the universe expands, in a sense, this negative pressure does negative work and pays for the positive energy that is the dark energy we've been talking about. So it all adds up to zero, and there's a lot of zero available for your free lunch.
Okay, well, on that note, I'd like to invite Dean Martin Grant up to the podium to wrap up and.
So I'm the person standing between you guys and the reception. So all I'd like to do basically is thank our panelists for doing a great job, for explaining this so well and giving the sense of the intellectual rigor of a real public scientific debate, something we haven't really seen at McGill for 100 years when Ernest Rutherford was debating in the physics and chemistry department colloquiums about the transmutation of the elements. I'd like to thank Vicky for a great job of moderating with a lot of big dogs on the panel, frankly. I'd like to thank Lauren Trache and the Trache Family Foundation for making this event possible in the first place. A great idea, Lauren, carried through successfully the second time. We'll do it again next year. Thank all the questioners, and particularly our two ringers, Richard Bernier and Professor Margaret Somerville, for their great questions. And well, I'll do a few more thank yous, and then we can plot again. Thank Tony Massey for introducing, very very sharp introduction, Tony, and very much to the point. I really appreciated it. And I'd like to thank Jean-Philippe Arsenault, the attaché politique, the Bureau du Ministre pour le Développement Économique, Innovation et Exploitation of our province, for coming here tonight. Like I said, this is the second Lauren Trache public debate in science. We'll have another one here next year. Hope to see you guys then. There are refreshments in the lobby, and I'd like the panelists, if they could stick around for a little while, to have some pictures with the dean. Thank you very much.